Blog Talk Radio.
Friday, May 9th, and this is Doug Kelly. Welcome to Paranexus Universe here with my co-host, Grant Rubendunce. Welcome, Grant. Okay, maybe I'm not here with my co-host. Welcome, Grant. Guess we lost Grant again. Poor Grant. Anyway, welcome, everybody. We've got some great guests tonight, Frank Fascino Jr. and Stanton Friedman with us. I want to mention before I introduce our guests that we will take live call-ins, so please take a look at your number there on the screen that you're seeing right in front of you. You can call in during the program, and we'll be happy to take those calls. There's also the chat room, and if you've got a question, you can just type it in there. We'll be happy to take that. So without any further ado, let's introduce our two guests tonight, Frank Fascino Jr. In the early 1990s, Fascino became involved in UFO and crop circle research in West Virginia. He frequently visited a relative's farm located in Braxton County, where crop circles appeared overnight. UFO sightings were frequent. This is when Frank learned about the 1952 Braxton County Monster incident, which occurred in Flatwoods near his cousin's farm. In 91, he contacted MUFON and was granted a meeting with crop circle enthusiast Colin Andrews. Shortly afterward, Frank met with MUFON representatives and Colin Andrews and supplied him with his West Virginia UFO and crop circle documentation. He continued to collaborate with Andrews about the ongoing anomalies occurring in Braxton County, but Frank's curiosity with the Flatwoods incident proved to be his calling, and so he began to investigate this 1952 incident at a deeper level and devoted all of his time to it. He has since moved to Florida to further his education, and he's also got a book. Is that out now, Frank?
The Shoot Them Down, the Flying Saucer Airwords in 1952 was released a few months ago.
Okay, great. Well,
I'm working on my next book, which is called The Flatwoods Monster from Myth to Reality.
Great. So welcome, Frank. Great to
Thanks
have
you. Thanks for having
me.
Hi, Stanton.
Hey. Hi. Let me introduce Stanton. Stanton, of course, many of you know Stanton Friedman. Received his BSc and MSc degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, TRW Systems, Aerojet, General, what is that, Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, classified, and eventually canceled projects as nuclear aircraft, fission, fusion rockets, nuclear power plants for space. Of course, Stanton's got a number of books out. One of the most recent was Captured. Welcome, Stan. It's a pleasure to have you as well.
I'm glad to be on.
So let's kind of bring our audience up to date a little bit on this Flatwoods Monster case. Maybe some people are not familiar with it. Frank, could you kind of give us a quick overview?
Well, what I want to jump into first is what was going on in the year 1952.
Sure, yeah, that would be
Project Blue Book, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, ATIC, was in charge of collecting all the data on the UFO sightings for several years. And in 1952, it was a banner year. There was actually a total of 1,501 sightings. And of those sightings, 303 were unidentified. So, like I said, this was a banner year for UFO sightings. Especially across the United States, we had the the back-to-back weekends in July of the Washington, D.C. flyovers, where interceptors were sent out over Washington to try and shoot them down. There were orders Harry Truman had given the Air Defense Command and the Navy to shoot down flying saucers if you couldn't talk them down. And that's what basically my book, Shoot Them Down, the Flying Saucer Air Wars in 1952, is about. And it was reported on July 29th. I'll give you the exact quote. Lieutenant Colonel Monsell Montz, he was the public information officer, he said the jet pilots are and have been under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down. So that kind of sets the stage for what was going on during that period. Well, when I started looking into the Flatwoods case, I was the first person who actually looked outside of Braxton County, where Flatwoods is located in the central part of the state of West Virginia. It's about 200 miles west of Washington, D.C. And what actually hit the press shortly after this incident was it was explained as a 12-foot-tall monster that a woman and seven kids saw. There was a group of boys, and they were playing football that night out on the Flatwoods Elementary School playground, and they saw this object. It was oval-shaped, ovoid, which was approximately 30 feet long by about 15 to 16 feet high. It looked like a big, giant egg. Went flying over the
back
center
again.
Of town. Pardon?
We lost him for a moment. Get him back. Keep going, Frank.
Flew over the town, and it was Friday night. It was close to 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, and all these kids saw this giant thing come over the top of the school playground, made a 45-degree angle turn, flew across the main road, and landed up on top of a farm across the street, approximately a mile away. Well, this group of boys ran up the street, up Route 19. They went to the house of Kathleen May. Two of the boys in the group, that was their mother. Their house actually bordered the Bailey Fisher Farm property where this thing was seen to have landed up on the back hill. So some of the boys chickened out, went home. They were scared. They didn't want to go up there. Some of the kids were yelling it was a flying saucer. Some of the kids said it was a meteor. You know, they were arguing, fighting. Kathleen May gathered the boys up. There was a 17-year-old cousin of Kathleen. His name was Eugene Lemon. He came along with the group, and they all proceeded up to the farm. They went up past a big metal gate that bordered the farm. Some of the group out way out in the distance saw some flashing lights. They were purplish, and they were flaring up. The whole area became engulfed in this mist, and it was described to me by the witnesses as smelling like sulfur, and it made them sick. They didn't know what it was. They started pushing on through the area. They went up onto the back hill of the farm. They came to the gate. Some of the group passed over the gate. They started moving up a little bit further, and some of the witnesses saw this gigantic object sitting out in the field. But what had actually happened is after this object landed on the far mountaintop, it actually relocated into the gully of the farm, approximately about an eighth of a mile away, and it was sitting up behind some pear trees that were actually an orchard back then in 1952. The property was used basically as a cow pasture. Mm. The group keeps moving forward. Lemon and Kathleen May were the two oldest. He was 17 years old. She was 35. They're moving up, and off to their left, set about 3 to 4 foot back along the perimeter of the woods, they heard these weird noises. It was like hissing noises and thumping noises. As they moved closer into this area, there was a dog who had tagged along from the neighborhood, dashed off towards this tree. The dog yelped and barked and took back off and ran back down the hill. Subsequently, they found the dog dead later on.
Mm.
They started moving towards this tree, and they, by now it's dusk, it was pretty well getting dark, and May and Lemon had flashlights on them. One of the Kathleen May's boys was standing behind her. Neil Nunley was another witness. He was there, and Ronnie Shaver. These boys are all between the age of 6 and 17 years old. They moved towards this tree, and they saw something about 12 foot up in the air behind and to the left of the tree. Lemon and May flashed their flashlights on this thing. They thought it was some type of an animal or something because the eyes were reflecting red up in the branch. Well, it wasn't an animal. This gigantic metallic figure that was made out of some type of a steel, and it was an aluminum color, came hovering out, and it passed in front of them. And it was basically about 12 foot tall. It had a giant apparatus over the top of its head shaped like an ace of spades. It had some type of antenna-type devices sticking out from the shoulders, and it flared out. It basically looked like a gigantic booster rocket. Hmm. Had pipes along the lower torso. That was what was emitting the gases, and this thing hovered, Mrs. May told me, about a foot to a foot and a half off the ground. The Lemon boy temporarily blacked out and passed out, and he fell over. One of the kids picked him up. The kids freaked out and screamed, ran back down the hill, and eventually Lemon got back up again. And this thing moved across the path in front of them, and that was the last point they saw, because they were scared out of their wits at that point, and they all ran back down to the house. And what happened from there is probably the most distorted story in history. I spoke to several witnesses firsthand, documented them, videotaped them, and have audio recordings of all the primaries involved in this. The myth of the monster actually occurred 1 week later when Mrs. May went on national television with Gene Lemon, and a sketch artist sat down with them, pre-production. He was talking to them, and they were trying to describe this thing to the sketch artist. Now, We the People was a big talk show back in that era. You know, question and answer. They had like the little panel set up with the witnesses, and Daniel Seymour was the announcer. Now, he was asking them all these questions, and he set the stage, you know, real spooky type atmosphere. They had a live orchestra pit, and they flashed this picture that the sketch artist did on national television. And when they showed it on the television, when it was broadcast, it was actually the incorrect way that the monster looked. And for over half a century now, we've seen this ridiculous, stupid-looking monster with claws and big bulging eyes and a long, flowing dress. And that is the myth of the Flatwoods Monster. Well, being an illustrator, I sat down with the primary witnesses, and I did sketches and drawings. I pulled out some of the old archives from the Charleston Gazette and different local papers, and I actually found out that this 12-foot-tall mechanical creature was actually described correctly. And it was about 4 to 5 days later that the myth began, the Flatwoods Monster myth. So it was actually represented correct right from the witnesses' mouths a couple days after the incident when it first hit the press. And for over 50 years, everybody's thought it's been a monster wearing a long, flowing dress.
Well, so who started the myth?
The sketch artist drew the picture wrong. And that was broadcast on Friday night, September 19th, 1952. On the 14th, the first description of the monster was given to the public of what it looked like, and it was described as a mechanical man. Shiny, you know, it gave the descriptions of this thing the way it actually looked like. was
the, more like a robot, in other words.
Yeah, robotic.
Man in it or something.
Yeah, mechanical man type device. And the front page of the Charleston Gazette gave this full blown description of what it actually looked like. And that was the end of it. The press picked up on it, you know, from that point forward and just made a big joke out of it. Then when the media got hold of it for the television show, and this one sketch artist is the one who actually botched this whole story up for over half a century. So the witnesses were disgusted the way that the media handled this thing, so they went into seclusion, and they wouldn't talk to anybody. Well, I have family that lives up in Flatwoods and throughout Braxton County, and they were able to get me in to speak to these people who wanted nothing to do with the story anymore. You know, it had been reported so bad, and it just became a big joke and a myth, and the people were laughed at.
There's another part of this, too. You have to recognize that to many people in the United States, West Virginia was, in 1952, basically hillbilly country. So that added to the mythology. You know, a bunch of dumb bunnies down there seeing this crazy thing. Why would you believe them, et cetera, et cetera? And, of course, Blue Book didn't help any with their explanations, as Frank found out when he finally got a copy of their full file. Would you say they goofed a little bit, Frank?
Quite a bit. What I said earlier is when I looked outside of Flatwoods and Braxton County, what I actually discovered that there was approximately 19 hours of continuous sightings over 80 locations of towns and cities up and down the eastern seaboard. This was not an isolated incident. Yeah.
That night, in your research, have you ever seen any indication that there was any fighter activity in the area, that they were doing any intercepting of objects that night or scrambled or anything?
What I basically did is I worked with, I live near Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, so I had a lot of access to maps, and I spoke to a lot of professors and worked with different people. And I made this gigantic map. There's pictures on my website of it. And the map, it covers a whole wall. And for several years, every time I found a piece of information, and believe it or not, the best information I found was in Blue Book. I pulled up the Blue Book files, and there was 180 pages of documentation for September 12, 1952. Of locations throughout the country. Wow. I picked up the paper trail and started going into the different areas through these 11 different states where these sightings occurred. And I started pinpointing and putting dots and markers all over this gigantic map and figuring out the times, flight paths, trajectories, the whole ball of wax on this big map. This took 10 to 12 years to put all of this together. Then Stanton came in, and he got some articles from Barry Greenwood and various sources and added more information to my case. So what I have is this gigantic map, and I work with a couple different people, police officers, military people, and they helped me put the flight path trajectories together on this map and drawing the flight lines, and we worked in reverse. We started, Flatwoods was actually the end of the story I discovered. We worked from left to right, and we pinpointed all of these locations, and there was three UFOs that flew in that night within minutes of each other across the eastern seaboard. We followed this continued line, and it came to 90 miles off the coast of the United States. All of these flight lines intersected there. The first flight line, the first flight path, actually came down, flew across the seaboard, and made a beeline for Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. It flew approximately 100 miles through the no-fly zone and was gunning directly for the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. The second object which came 90 miles off the coast where this intercept point was, flew directly across Baltimore, and I pinpointed its locations, and it went up all the way towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it stopped just a short distance from Wright Pat. The third object came over the eastern seaboard, flew over Washington, D.C. I tracked it. Now, when it flew over Washington, D.C., it made the front page of several papers, and it was in the New York Times. It was called The Flame Over Washington. This object was flying about treetop level over D.C., and I tracked it. And it flew 206 miles across Washington, Virginia. It went into West Virginia. At the northern tip of Braxton County, it made a 45-degree angle turn and turned down Route 19, followed Route 19, and the railroad tracks, flew in between the valleys and flew into Flatwoods.
Wow.
That's when the kids saw it. So you have the activity of three different damaged craft. And these were all said to have been one meteor. So,
isn't that the most magnificent meteor you ever heard of?
A convenient meteor.
Very convenient meteor. And we should stress here again that 52, the summer of 52, was the busiest season ever for Project Blue Book. Headlines all over the place, especially because of the Washington, D.C. sightings in July. And the press was looking pretty decently at some of this stuff, the scramblings, the radar operators at the Washington airports talking, and so forth. So this was not a quiet time for UFOs. It was the busiest time ever. But Frank and I found, after some people didn't like his first book, where he had suggested that maybe there was conflict going on between military planes and UFOs, I asked for help from some of my associates, and they're the ones who dug out these articles about the order to shoot them down. But that wasn't, believe it or not, it wasn't in the Washington Post. It wasn't in the New York Times. It was in a number of respectable papers, you understand. And we even have a letter from the head of the American Rocket Society to President Truman saying he didn't think this shoot-them-down order was a good idea, not very hospitable and all that sort of thing. But we also found this order, not only did we find articles about it, but we also found an Air Force general saying we'd scrambled them planes more than, 300 times, wasn't it, Frank?
300 times.
Yeah, that was an Air Force general with an interesting name, Roger Ramey, who had also been involved in the Roswell incident.
Roswell, yeah.
Yeah, he had another star now. But the point I'm getting at here is that despite all the attention, until just the last couple of years, we weren't aware of these, call it dogfights between airplanes and the UFOs, and we also found, an obvious question is, well, did we shoot them down or not? We don't know, but we do know that an awful lot of airplanes crashed. What was it, 205 or something, Frank, between 1951 and 56, sometime around
then? Yeah, I did a little independent case study just of New York Times, just alone, and there were 204 actual stories that involved U.S. fighter aircraft accidents. And the total amount of fighters, you know, these basically in that area you have the Thunder Jets, Starfire, Sabre Jets. You know, they were pretty modern, state-of-the-art jets. And they were carrying rockets at that point, which is something else that I looked into. They carried the 2.75-inch Mighty Mouse rockets. And the F-86D Sabre jet, the Sabre Dog, the Starfire, F-94C, and the F-7U3 Cutlass that the Navy was flying, the jet that looked like a big bat, that thing was also equipped with these rockets. And this is what they were sending out on the Washington weekends.
I remember now, over 200 planes crashed.
229.
Including three pilots who had over 100 missions in Korea, where there were MiGs trying to shoot them down, you know? Mm-hmm. They come back to the United States. These guys got to be pretty good pilots to survive over 100 missions in Korea. They come back to the United States, and they crash. And they used a couple of interesting words in some of the articles from the New York Times, namely disappeared, disintegrated. How are those for terms about airplane crashes?
Well, of all those cases, guys, there were 26 cases of vanished fighter aircraft. And interestingly enough, out of those 26, these are incidents around the world. 19 of the incidents, now this is just fighter jets, occurred over the United States.
Vanished.
35 vanished airmen.
And never found.
Never found, just vanished
now,
off the planet. And many of these incidents over major cities.
There's another part to this story. You say, okay, pilots were ordered to shoot at the UFOs, but did the UFOs shoot back? Now, maybe that's why some of these planes crashed, but I have independently heard 7 different accounts of more planes going up after a UFO than came back down, strongly implying that they were taken out. Now, that bothers some people, and I know some people will say, what do you mean? Weren't their families told that they died, you know, were shot down by a UFO? No, they weren't. And for those who wonder, could they really keep that secret, I would refer you to a book called By Any Means Necessary by William Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S. He's a historian and a journalist, and it's a book about 166 military crewmen who went down in reconnaissance planes, U.S. military crewmen, who went down in reconnaissance planes that were, I guess the word they used was tickling, the radar in North Korea, China, and Russia, starting in the late 40s. The families were first told what happened to their sons, brothers, fathers, whatever, in 2001. For those who think secrets can't be kept, that's when the families found out what happened to their family members. 2001, even though someone was down in the 40s and 50s. So,
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely right. Yeah, because they did the same thing over Russia, too. And a lot of times that information didn't come forth until around the same time.
That's right. So what I'm saying is I would love to hear from anybody listening, not who got shot down, obviously, because he ain't with us no more, but about maybe he was a ground guy, a fellow pilot, somebody who knows about such incidents. Because, look, if I've heard 7, and, yeah, I get around a lot, but still, if I've heard 7, it's got to have happened a lot more than that. And so, and when Frank also found out that, what was it, 67 pilots didn't bail out, Frank?
Right, 67 out of 204 fighter accident cases, the men did not bail out.
Which is very unusual, according to all the pilots we've talked to.
Very high average.
Yeah. So they didn't have a chance to bail, is what you're saying.
But who knows? Where did
Why didn't they bail? Were they dead by the time they hit the ground or the water? Or, you know, was their equipment malfunction, they weren't able to eject?
It's what I'm saying is we're talking here about the tip of the iceberg, about what was really going on. And there's a book by Tim Good, Need to Know. He's the English researcher. He's written several good UFO books. And he also talks about similar things happening in Europe in that time frame. Let me talk about the one example where the guy didn't die because his guns weren't loaded. There was a case in South Carolina. A guy, pilot was on duty, Navy pilot, gets scrambled. The Air Defense Command says, you know, there's a bogey coming in. So he dashes to the airplane about 10 o'clock at night, takes off, they vector him in, he gets up at 20,000 feet, where the heck is the UFO? Looks down, there it is, way down there. And suddenly it comes straight up and then comes heading toward him. And a very bright light, and he puts his hand up. The light is so bright, you can see the bones in his hand, which is kind of a scary notion. And so he squeezes the trigger. That's what he's supposed to do. We have an intruder, you know, take defensive action. Nothing happens because the guns hadn't been loaded. And meanwhile, he's talking to the guys on the ground, of course, as you're supposed to when you're on an intercept mission. And when he comes down and he lands, he gets interrogated for a few hours by guys in suits as well as guys in uniform. I've talked to this gentleman. He went on to be a lawyer. He's still alive and fully mentally sharp, I'll tell you that. And we agree that probably the only reason that he's alive is that somebody forgot to load the guns. But, you know, how many other instances are there that the public hasn't been told about? And, you know, is this the deep, dark secret of UFOs? And did we succeed in shooting down some of them, maybe?
They certainly went to extremes to cover up all the activity, and I just have this picture in my mind, gentlemen, of Washington going bonkers over this whole incident because the public was starting to get kind of panicky around the time that this incident happened in Flatwoods.
Well, there was a huge press conference on July 29th, at which General what was his name, Frank? General Samford.
They
all have explanations. It's temperature inversions and stuff. It was the biggest press conference since the end of World War II. And the military was certainly concerned. And you don't give a shoot-them-down order unless you are concerned. It is very interesting that in a memo written in 1969, I guess it was, by General Carol Bolander, who was asked to, Air Force General, he was asked to look at what should we do about Project Blue Book, because the Condon report earlier in the year had said, forget about Blue Book, it's not doing anything useful anyway. General Bolander, who had nothing to do with Blue Book beforehand, wound up recommending that the project be closed. This is in October, and it was closed a few months later. Now, the interesting thing is, in his memo, he said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army-Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's a very strong statement. Two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the regulations established for that purpose. Now, think about that. The public has never been told by the Air Force, hey, Blue Book didn't get the good stuff. You know, suppose a saucer flies down the runway at a SAC base, a Strategic Air Command base, where nuclear weapons are stored. That's a national security problem. But you and I might see it in our backyard, and I've never seen one, but what the heck? That's not a national security problem. So this whole business about two sides to the coin, the public and the military side, here's a blatant statement, and I talked to General Bolander, incidentally, while he was alive. He's dead now. And there's no question that he meant what he said, and he understood what he said. A very sharp guy. He was an engineer who worked on the lunar excursion module, incidentally. So we have here, in other words, a very different picture about the government and flying saucers. Way back in the 50s, early 50s, with 52, it's sort of the end of that time frame, if you will. I mean, September, the Flatwoods time at the end of that. But you wonder, where is all that data about planes trying to shoot them down and how many planes got zapped by the saucers?
Well, Stan, I'm going to give the listeners, you guys give me a minute here. This is going to set the reality forth a little bit of what I discovered with the New York Times. Out of the 204 cases, 21 of the cases, they were combat veterans died. Two of them vanished. Okay. And I found the data about the top nine combat mission veterans. I'm going to throw these numbers out and just let this sink into you as I'm reading these off to you, okay? As a memoriam, I'm going to read these flyers' names. 182 combat missions, Captain Gentile. 130 combat missions, Colonel Council. 105 combat missions, Captain Gay. 100 combat missions, Captain Wagner. 100 combat missions, Lieutenant Burke. 85 combat missions, Major Engel. 81 combat missions, Captain Lundberg. 70 combat missions, Lieutenant Lewis. 32 combat missions, Lieutenant Bernard. Stanton, those nine pilots, okay, add up to 885 total combat missions. All of these men died over the United States.
That's pretty depressing, isn't it? But it's
World War II and Korea combat veterans.
And how can you account for that? You know, that just doesn't make sense.
Four of them were aces. Gentile, Welsh, Brown, and Moore were all aces. These men all died over the United States.
So we're talking, in other words, here, a very different picture. And trying to get accident records, I found out, it took us an awful long time to get a few. And we found files that were missing. You know, you got a number, but it's not there. I was at the National Archives.
The September files were missing.
Well, Frank has the accident report having to do with two pilots in Florida there, right off the coast. And all the double talk, the nonsense that came up in the discussion. Somebody's lying through their teeth. There are lots of somebody's apparently about what's going on. So, you know, people say, oh, you bunch of conspiracy theorists. We're not talking conspiracy. We're talking about an active effort to misrepresent what happened. And, you know, like it or not, and without trying to sort out what the reasons are, maybe you're really afraid of panic if you tell pilots, hey, guys, when they tell you to go shoot at those UFOs, they may shoot back. I don't know how many would want to go up under those circumstances.
Well,
know?
here's something very interesting. In my latest book, Shoot Them Down, chapter 7 of my book is actually dedicated to Stanton, and chapter 7 is called The Flying Saucer Physicist. And when Stanton was in Washington, he found a memorandum, which is a tabulation of major accidents and that involve fighters, bombers, cargo, and so on. But Stanton found the actual documentation for the aircraft accident situation in July of 1952 and June 1952. And Stanton dug this out, and as far as I know, this has never been put public before until it was put in Chapter 7. June 1952, I'm going to read you now. These are quotes, men. Fighter major accidents in June, 100. Fighter fatalities, 21. Fighter aircraft destroyed, 36. Now, the July data are preliminary. July 1952, fighter major accidents, 135. Fatalities, 30. 58 fighter aircraft were destroyed in July alone.
Wow.
So
any particular air bases were this? Can you relate it back to which air bases were they in the close vicinity to Washington, D.C., Frank?
No, what Stanton found here was just a tabulation. You know, this is what he found when we were – Stanton was actually looking for the September data, and they were yanked from the files. When the Norton Air Force Base accident reports were released, the first thing Stanton and I did was look at the information for September 12th, and the two men who disappeared off the coast of Tampa right before the Flatwoods incident hit the fan, there was no record of these men for years. I contacted the Air Force, civil agencies. These men were never born, and they had never died. There are no Social Security death index on these guys until the accident reports came out. And what was interesting, when the accident report was released, the case file before and the case file after are gone, and they were sent to higher classification.
In other words, it gets very frustrating when you try to dig into this. That's why we're looking, and we're reachable. I mean, my website is www.stantonfriedman.com, and their addresses and email address and phone numbers and all that sort of thing. We'd really like to hear from people because we're racing the Undertaker. You know, I worked on Roswell an awful long time, but that was in 1947. So those guys are mostly gone, but there's still some people left from 1952, and that was the big time for UFO activity. So, you know, we need more help in getting at the facts here. And one of the key people on the Roswell story was retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. And you've seen his picture in General Ramey's office where Ramey's holding that interesting piece of paper and with the crazy wreckage on the floor and stuff.
Right.
Anyway, what Dubose told, I managed to locate him while he was alive, of course. And when he was about 87, he said, "Stan, if I remember anything more, I'll tell you, I like what you're doing. What can they do to me now?" And so we're looking for people who are saying, "What can they do to me now?" And let us know your story. We'd like to hear more. And, you know, I have a great deal of respect for war veterans, for military guys. And we'd like to hear from them just to get the facts straight. And I have I should add, you know, I'm not a willy-nilly, the public is entitled to know everything. I worked under security for 14 years. I think there's a legitimate reason for keeping a lot of secrets. But in this case, remember, the Air Force has very loudly proclaimed that UFOs are not a threat to the security of the United States. So if that's the case, why can't they talk about some of the things that happened? I don't want technical data. You know, Osama bin Laden can listen to this broadcast too, you know, or his buddies. But from people who were involved in activities, especially back then, when we know things were very hot. Now, what I don't know is how soon they lifted this cockamamie rule about shoot them down. Because there are stories about the Russians were doing the same thing, incidentally. So,
well, Stan, if I could just interrupt for a second.
Sure.
In your work that you did on MJ-12, was there any records that mentioned the UFO flap? Certainly, if MJ-12 was in operation, and as it should have been, they must have been pretty flipped out about this whole situation.
Well, there is a comment in the Eisenhower briefing document that starting in, what was it, late May, I guess, there's been a great increase in UFO activity, which was of considerable concern. And that's what it says in one of the MJ-12 documents. So this may very well be the kind of – that's a document that was written on 18 November 1952, a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower. He won the election on November 4th, didn't become president until the following January 20th. But the point is that in a briefing dated 18 November, it mentions that this great increase in the number and the amount of activity – starting in late May, and it shows up in the Blue Book files.
Actually, Stan, and in May, there were 79 reports. June, it jumped to 148. July skyrocketed to 536. May, June, July.
Wow.
So you can see why somebody said that there was great concern. The text is in my book, Top Secret Magic of course, and Crash at Corona as well. And in my new book, I haven't mentioned it so far.
As well, go for
please
it.
Please do.
Flying Saucers and Science, New Page Press, the same outfit that published Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by myself and Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece. And they surprised me by the book did so well, that one, when it came out, that they wanted to go ahead with mine. So what the heck, let's do it. And it should be out. Should be out by the end of this month, and you'll find it on Amazon. They're selling advanced copies. What a great way to get people's money without having to pay interest on it, huh?
Absolutely.
You know,
hey, Stan, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
In regards, just refresh my memory. took his plunge out of the building. Wasn't it around that same time frame?
Repeat the question.
Forrestal? I didn't hear the question, but...
Repeat the question, Grant.
The question is, the death of James Forrestal, didn't it occur around that same timeline?
No, no. Forrestal died in 49, May of 49.
Okay.
And we still don't know exactly what happened. Well, we know he wound up dead on the ground. We know that, right, from a six-story window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. But whether he was pushed or committed suicide or some nefarious plot took place, I don't know. And I stay away from trying to, you know, throw darts at a dartboard to come up with a conclusion as to what happened.
Yeah.
We know he died. That much we know. And he was a member, had been a member of MJ-12. Not surprisingly, he was the head of the Defense Department. MJ-12 being set up in 1947, September 24th, I guess it was. And so Forrestal then was still Secretary of Defense. But he... Forrestal had a troubled history, and, you know, he did have mental health problems. I've read documents, letters, and so forth, that things the FBI wrote about him. And, you know, there are people who say he ran down the hall saying the Martians are coming. There are other people who say he ran down the hall saying the Russians are coming. The fact of the matter is we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very tight about medical records back then. We tried to go through, Bill Moore and I tried to go through one of his sons and had no luck getting access to the medical records. So what can you say?
I was just curious because I thought perhaps it might have been, I knew it was within several years or might have been close. And in light of the magnitude of the flyovers and the activity that you gentlemen have discussed, I just wondered if there might have been a little correlation there. But
doesn't seem to
have not.
Been.
Yeah.
No. Sorry about that. It's a great story.
Yeah, it was worth a stab.
Oh, well, we could just make something up, too.
No, we can't.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, we serious researchers like Frank and myself have rules and standards, and we're concerned about getting at the truth. The debunkers, on the other hand, they are not so constrained. They have four basic rules. And you can use these to debunk anything, you understand. It's not just UFOs. The first is, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Preach it, brother.
Second is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. The third is, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. Nobody will know the difference anyway. And the fourth is, do your research by proclamation because investigation is too much trouble. And the press won't know the difference anyway. You know, and so,
I love those.
There are many examples of these, and I've found, and people who are interested in ghosts and other so-called paranormal stuff, they run into the same kind of basic rules. And what's aggravating, and there's a chapter in my new book about press coverage of UFOs, and what's aggravating is how I'll call the press a co-conspirator, not of a great conspiracy, but they seem to have accepted a basic syndrome here. Everybody agrees if aliens were visiting Earth, that would, and the government's covering it up on top of it, that would be a very big story, right? Nobody doubts that. But if that were true, those of us who think very highly of ourselves and who know about what's important in the world excuse me, would have known about it if it were true. So since we didn't know about it, it must not be true, and I'm not going to waste my time finding out about this crazy stuff. It's circular reasoning. There is no evidence, meaning, I'm not going to waste my time looking for evidence. What are you talking about? If there were, I would know about it. And I've had people in Washington who take this same attitude, well, in effect saying, hey, I'm somebody important. If all of this was going on, I would know about it, which totally ignores the basic rules for need to know and security and all that sort of stuff.
Everything is
compartmentalized. Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stan. I couldn't get the words out tonight.
Well, the point is that, you know, people tell me, you can't cover things up. I've heard some of the SETI cultists, as I call them in my book. I have a whole chapter on SETI. Well, what is a cult? It's a group with charismatic leadership, strong dogma, strong resistance to outside ideas.
Eye control.
Doesn't that sound like SETI? I mean, yeah. Silly effort to investigate. That's what it stands for. You knew that was coming.
Well,
you know, somebody has to call an idiotic notion an idiotic notion. And that's what SETI is all about. And so it's unfortunate that the media haven't done their job. They've been aided and abetted, you understand, by not only the SETI people, but one of the things that has aggravated me over the last 40 years, 35 years, is the attitude of the science fiction writers toward UFOs. Many people think, hey, well, there's a natural match between science fiction and ufology, right? Wrong. And in the book, there's a chapter about that goes into Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Ben Bova, three prominent science fiction guys. And some of the dumb things they've said. It's truly incredible. I mean, I respect Isaac Asimov. He's a great author, written, 400 books about everything under the sun. But no imagination and no knowledge whatsoever about UFOs. And that's the thing that sticks out. When you listen to the SETI guys, you never, ever hear reference to the large-scale scientific studies about UFOs. In my lecture, I cover 5 large-scale scientific studies, and I ask my audiences, how many here have read after each one? I show a slide, Tillotson, and Mullen. I'm lucky if I get 2%. You never hear the SETI guys say, well, in this study we found this, or it was found that, or something like that. What they say is, there is no evidence. Seth Shostak has said that. excuse me, Carl.
But they're optimistic that we'll get evidence soon.
Well, you know, what people forget is if aliens are visiting Earth, and the government knows all about them, who the heck needs SETI?
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Why, you're listening for signals? Why don't you learn sign language? They're coming here, fellas. You know.
Well,
so it's aggravating to me as a scientist to hear scientific people, Dr. Jill Tarter, for example, along with Seth Shostak, they've made a whole bunch of silly comments that, you know, this is science. No, it isn't.
But it's almost misleading of the public, don't you think, Stan, in the sense that... I would think that, you know, SETI, the radio waves are probably, of course, they're ubiquitous, they're everywhere in the universe, but I would think that a more sophisticated spacefaring culture would be communicating in a different manner. So we might as well be just like shooting or, you know, shooting stuff out to nobody. Who's going to be listening on that wavelength?
Well, they're listening. They're presuming that they know the technology of an advanced civilization. They don't know where it is. We've only had radio for roughly 100 years, 100 plus or minus 10, you know, depending where you are and all that sort of thing. We live on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old. Just down the street, there are stars that are 1 billion years older than the sun. And somehow, we are so clever. You know, I got my comeuppance about advanced technology. I was talking to 2 college classes at the University of Detroit and going through how much technology has changed in my lifetime, you know, and how lucky the kids are to have computers and all of the internet and all the rest of that. And I said, you know, when I started working in industry, I was using the slide rule. And I could see no reaction whatsoever in the classes. So I had the gall to ask, any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one student did. And that was less than 50 years. So it gives you an idea. What will the world be like 200 years from now?
Yeah.
Or 2,000 or 2 million.
Yeah. All right. Well, and we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we're going to take a short break here in just a few minutes. But I wanted to, Stanton, you talked about your books, and Frank, can you mention yours as well? And how to...
My recent book is called Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars in 1952. And I'm finishing up the final touches on my newest book called The Flatwoods Monster, From Myth to Reality. It's a 56-year case study of the Flatwoods Monster incident.
Okay, and those are available where?
Shoot Them Down is available at Amazon and about 100 different locations throughout the world.
Okay.
If you could just go out on my website, it's www.flatwoodsmonster.com.
Okay,
and
good.
You could find it there.
Good, and those websites are also on paranexusradio.org, so...
Good.
Yeah, and if you go to paranexusradio.org, which is a subsite of paranexus.org, you can just look for the page. Just look on there. You'll see Frank Fascino Jr. and Stan Friedman on our show tonight. Go to that page, and the websites are right there. So that's great. And speaking of Paranexus, as always, I want to encourage folks out there to take a look at paranexus.org. Paranexus is, as you probably know, a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, researchers, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, even psychically gifted individuals and enthusiasts. The goal, understand the human condition better through scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena, and especially its reality, its reach, its impact on humanity. I mean, earlier, before we went on air, we were talking about how, well, we were joking about perhaps how some of this stuff all interconnects. And it may or may not, but there is one thing that does interconnect it. We're all studying this to understand better the human condition. And I've been saying that for a while, and I'll continue to say it. This, we're all trying to figure out. So take a look at paranexus.org. We have charter memberships now, $5 for 6 months. We are gaining more and more serious researchers. And Paranexus is not an investigative group per se. It's an association of researchers who want to share, network, brainstorm, bounce ideas off, etc. So take a look at that. And for our listeners as well, don't forget that we are taking live calls tonight. If you'd like to call in after the break, the number's there on your screen, 347-945-7799. You can also ask questions in the chat room if you want to log in and go in there. We'd love to hear from you. And if you'll hang with us for just a few, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Hang with us.
The West Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
shadows. In the sky, it's Paranexus Universe. Darkness follows.
And welcome back to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, and with my co-host Grant Rubendunce. You with us, Grant? I think Grant's having a mic problem right now. But we are in the middle of an interview with two great guests, Frank Machino Jr. and Stanton Friedman. Welcome back, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
We're back.
That was great, man. And
we're
welcome
back,
Stanton. Nice to have you guys.
I'm glad too.
Hey, you got to have some fun here, huh? Now, just a quick reminder, folks, if you have any questions for Frank or for Stanton or for both, feel free to call in. You can call in live. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. Feel free to come into the chat room and ask your questions there. We'd love to address those questions. Now, Frank, you've got a little bit more on the Flatwoods Monster. That's the core discussion that we're talking about tonight. You want to take off and let us know what you've got, some more info on the concerning Blue Book?
Yeah, sure. Like I said earlier, is what I discovered, and my primary sources were 180 pages of Project Blue Book documentation, that this was not an isolated incident whatsoever. There were Project Blue Book actually listed 8 different states up and down the eastern seaboard, minus California that was sighting that night. And then what was not listed, when I dug in a little bit deeper, and then Stanton came on board and helped me investigate a little deeper, Ohio, Delaware, and Tennessee. And they were 3 of the most important sightings. Nothing appeared in Blue Book there. I just followed the paper trail from Blue Book, and I just went further, and I actually went into an omnidirection around Flatwoods, like radar, and just kept scoping out further and further. And when I would pick up the flight path trajectories of where these objects were seen, I would just keep moving on that flight line. That's how I was able to reenact what actually happened that night. And in Project Blue Book, I was able to figure out, and this is something that was overlooked by everyone, between 8 o'clock p.m. and 8:10 p.m. over the Washington area, Washington, Virginia, and Maryland, 12 UFOs descended over those 3 states within seconds after the Flatwoods Monster craft passed heading west over Washington, which was called, according to the New York Times and the Boston Globe, the Flame Over Washington, which I stated earlier. It flew 206 miles west. It took approximately 30 minutes for this object from the time the point it passed over Washington till it landed, approximately 30 minutes. Now, Project Blue Book gave their final analysis and said it was the Great Washington Area Meteor, and it was seen for 5 to 6 seconds.
And yet it did a 45-degree turn.
Right, and it took 30 minutes. Remember, from the point it passed over Washington, and it was sighted going all over different points along Virginia into West Virginia, and then when it hit northern Braxton County, and then it made a 45-degree angle turn and came south into Flatwoods, was close to a half an hour, not 5 to 6 seconds. Now, this is all in Blue Book. Then I found more information in newspapers, and then Stanton found more information, and we put this big timeline of events together. And like I said earlier, I worked in reverse, coming from Flatwoods back towards the coast and then going all different directions to see what was going on that night. And what I found out, now, it was very confusing trying to distinguish some of these different time zones, and Stanton and I went through this for years. There was different time zones in West Virginia.
In the same state.
In the same state. And some towns across the street, it was an hour difference, an hour ahead or an hour back. You have all these different time zones. So when the papers were reporting these dozens of UFOs, and there were dozens, all these sightings all over the country, it was very confusing for the press. Because one object would fly over Washington. Now, Washington was in a different time zone from West Virginia, and the Wheeling, northern panhandle of West Virginia, was in a different time zone from the rest of the state. So when these objects were flying all over a period of 19 hours, the press was completely confused with the time zone changes.
So that understandably.
This took several years to figure out in what time zones these areas were in, and I actually went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and I found an airplane book for September 1952 that gave the time zones and all the changes for all the flights of that particular day and what was going on. So a lot of work went into this. Stanton and I worked very hard on this to put this together and figure out the time zones. And once we put all of this together, I went into Blue Book, and there was 180 pages, and I was able to distinguish between 8 o'clock and 8:10, 12 UFOs descended over those three states. Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland. And the Flatwoods craft, when it passed over treetop level, it actually buzzed Washington. When it passed over Washington, got outside of the Washington area west, 12 UFOs descended over different points. It's all documented in my book. And then they moved west and followed it.
I should stress here that, you know, I mentioned the basic rules for debunkers. Now, everybody who knows anything about meteors know they don't take very long to go from point A to point B. And I love the explanation for Flatwoods from Dr. Joseph Nickel, who's head of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, used to be the self-anointed Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormals, you know. Now, Joe, he's highly qualified as a scientific investigator. He has 3 degrees in English, and he worked as a magician. And certainly, magicians are masters of deception, so it seems appropriate. Anyway, here's the kicker. Joe concluded, he visited Flatwoods, but he didn't go up at the actual location, didn't talk to any of the witnesses, and as we've said, there are a number of alive witnesses. But he came up with a very simple explanation. What flew in the sky was a meteor. Now, the kids saw this thing make a turn around the town slowly and come down. And you know what? There was no shock wave. There was no big noise, no crater, no nothing. In addition, he explained very straightforwardly, the monster, so-called, was a 6-foot-tall owl. Everybody knows that there are lots of those flying around West Virginia. I mean, come on, that's the owl center of the world, you know.
Well, but they're not a tree branch.
Depends on what you're smoking, yeah, too.
You know, what I'm trying to say here is contrast all the work that Frank has talked about and the Blue Book files and so forth and what people reported, observed, et cetera. And then you come up with a simplistic, totally stupid explanation. It wasn't a meteor. It flew much too slowly, and there was no evidence of a meteor like a crater or anything like that. And 6-foot owl is out of the question when you know, how come the kids got sick? Now, we haven't talked about the testimony from Colonel Levitt, whom, of course, nobody else has talked to besides Frank, but he was in charge of the National Guard in the area. He got called from Washington. Well, you tell the story, Frank. It's your story. You talk to him.
When I started interviewing the witnesses up in Flatwoods, Kathleen May told me that the National Guard was up there. And I had only read one little blurb about the National Guard's participation in the Flatwoods incident. Then I started talking with some of the locals, and it was actually well known. Picture for yourself a town of 300, a little small town. 10,000 people went into Flatwoods within the first 4 to 5 weeks. they trampled this little town. This is how big this story was. This was not a little covered-up story. 10,000 people went into that town. They practically destroyed it. Of the press, the media, radio, television, everybody and their mother was there. They were coming in from all over the world. Now, the West Virginia National Guard was there indeed. We knew that. I found that out. They were there for crowd control because the people were just tromping this farm area, the neighborhood where Kathleen May was. The guard came in and they had cordoned off the area. And reporters were allowed up there. They were scared people were going to get hurt from running around through the hills and the mountains. But what I found out is that Kathleen May set an interview up with me, and I spoke to the commander of the West Virginia National Guard, and his name was Colonel Dale Leavitt. He was a paratrooper during World War II and, you know, combat veteran. Well, when I spoke to Leavitt the first time, he informed me I was up there that night with my troops. And there's nothing in the press. There's not anything there. He was told to be quiet and not to talk about this. He was on a covert mission that night. He received a call from Washington. And he came up through the back end of the farm, not the main access road. They didn't want to wake the neighborhood up. They came up a few hours after the incident. And I was actually taken on that route. It was an old log road that came up through the northern part of the property. And Leavitt told me when he received the call, there was approximately 180 troops that he had to pull together. Now, there were UFOs crashing throughout Braxton County that night. This was not the only UFO that crashed up on the Fisher Farm that night.
There was more than one?
There was more than one. It was a flap over Flatwoods. There were several of them there.
Really?
Actually, a few miles down the road along the Elk River, which cuts through Braxton County, there was what was thought to be an airplane crash. And the sheriff had went out there with men. They went across the river with boats. They were all over the place. They couldn't find anything. Well, the call went through a hierarchy and reached Washington out of Braxton County through the state police, through Charleston. Then it went up to Washington, called back down to Leavitt's home. He got a call at his home. He got the troops together. He was told to go down the Elk River to go to the first area where there was a crash. They never found anything. There were people driving throughout the area. People out walking their dogs. It was seen by dozens of people. What this thing, damaged craft, is actually puddle jumping throughout Braxton County. Leavitt went there with 180 troops, cordoned off the area, and they were looking for survivors. They were told it was a plane crash. Leavitt told me they never found the plane. He set the troops up there. Shortly after, he went with nearly 60 guardsmen. They came in through the back road of the farm. They went up and cordoned the farm off, and they took soils of what was like looked like little black plastic, oil, different pieces on the farm. And Leavitt was told to take all of these samples and pack them up. What surprised me is when I interviewed Leavitt, the first time he wouldn't let me bring a camera or any type of recording device. Eventually, I got to go onto the farm and I videotaped his testimony and I asked him questions. And I asked Leavitt, how long were you on the farm with your troops? And he told me the troops stayed there the night. And I said, well, what about you? He had to go back down the river to continue in the search down there. There was 50 to 60 men in the Flatwoods farm. He said he was told to stay there for the night in case something else happened.
And what
nobody else has talked to Leavitt, incidentally, and he's no longer with us.
that was the funny part about it is, what was another meteor going to land there? He was ordered by Washington to stay on the farm for the night. And the troops stayed up there till the sun came up, and they left Leavitt had went back down the Elk River, and he packed the whole troops, all the troops up, and then they left because they never found anything. What these objects were actually puddle jumping throughout Braxton County. They were seen by hundreds of people throughout the area. Leavitt sent the samples back to Washington. He told me he shifted them back off, and he never heard anything again. I'm the only person that has an interview with Leavitt.
So how many crashes were there?
Who knows?
I tracked four damaged UFOs. One came from the south, and three came from the eastern seaboard. And what is amazing is how the press documented. You know, dozens of newspapers were documenting these things that were going down. And, you know, they were all described pretty well. I'm going to throw a couple quotes at you. Pieces falling off, exploding, sparkling in showers, strange noises were coming from the object, disappearing, then reappearing, and these objects were actually making repeated landings. When I first started working with Stanton several years ago on this, what Stanton picked up on was the flight path trajectories of these damaged objects. They were following the flight path corridors for airlines.
Really?
Yes.
Hey, why not? You know, pilots used to look to follow the railroad tracks kind of thing.
And they were actually following rivers. They were going in between mountains. And actually, it's well documented up in the Wheeling area that night, one of the UFOs nearly collided with a passenger plane. And several airlines were avoiding this thing as it was flying through their flight path. It's in the front pages of half a dozen newspapers in West Virginia. Everybody forgot about it.
Well,
so they were recording these quite accurately. This isn't something that's made up. We have dozens of newspapers throughout the country talking about these objects.
The problem here is that there was no central civilian clearinghouse where there was no mutual UFO network. NICAP didn't exist. APRO didn't exist. There was nobody who had a serious interest and had people that he could gather together to fan out and do the work that needed to be done at the time. It's unlike, for example, Stephenville, Texas, in January, you know, MUFON came in there, and there were hundreds of people who came to report their sightings within days of the original event. You know, I mean, of course, we had deception down there, too. I love the business of, we didn't have any F-16s flying. 10 days later, you know, there were 10 of them. You know, like the F-16 is a miniature silent airplane or something. And they can't keep tabs on them. I mean, but the point of this is that there was an awful lot going on, and Frank's had to work, you know, umpteen years later to dig into it. That's why I mentioned we'd certainly like to hear from people who were involved. But the book is an example of a couple of things. One, deception on the part of the government. Two, how an awful lot of blood, sweat, and tears on Frank's part can collect an awful lot of data with help from some other people, and it was kind of good that somebody gave us a hard time about there weren't any dogfights, and then so I asked people to send me stuff, and we got a lot of it. And look, I've been interested in UFOs since 1958. I didn't know about that shoot them down order until just a few years ago when we were digging into this. And you wonder how many other people didn't know about it, even though we found this letter from, what was the name, Farnsworth, the head of the American Rocket
Society. Yeah, Robert Farnsworth.
You know, so we know that the order was there. We have the newspaper articles. But you do have to ask, so how come the Washington Post, which did cover that big press conference in July that year, and the New York Times, why didn't they pick up on the story about shoot them down? Names were given. This wasn't a rumor, in other words. Frank mentioned the guy's name, one of them, earlier. So in a small way, this epitomizes the whole mess that ufology has been in with the failure of the press, with the failure of the government to come clean, with the failure of the people involved able to stand up and be counted, and with a lot of misrepresentation on the part of the so-called scientific investigators. And you wonder how many other cases, how many other instances of other activities have we been misrepresented to? That's kind of scary stuff. Now, I should add something else in here for the younger members of the audience who don't happen to have been around back then. 52, we were fighting in Korea. We were just realizing that the Russians had made a lot of progress in the development of nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them. I saw a National Security Council meeting minutes had been classified where somebody said they had made more progress in the last 18 months in developing nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them than had been expected for 5 years. The point I'm getting at is the country was very nervous. We were over in Korea. Maybe the Russians were going to attack us. There was serious fears of that happening. And so we didn't have enough radar. Can you imagine, before we could get the radar installed, we had to set up the Ground Observer Corps. Hey, guys, there's a bunch of Russian airplanes coming in. You know, call your friends. what I'm saying is 52 was a time of great consternation. The Korean War was not going as well as we had hoped. The Chinese, you know, had come down in droves and stuff. And it's just a good thing from a lot of people's viewpoint that Stalin died in early 53, not too long after Ike took office. But there was a lot of unease, shall we say, a lot of concern. And wouldn't you expect that just as we wanted to know the flight capabilities of Soviet airplanes, that the aliens want to know our flight capabilities, what our weapons were? It's standard military concern. You're going to fly in harm's way, you better know what the other guy can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly wouldn't make our government look very good if our airspace was being violated and there wasn't much they could do about it.
Nobody likes to admit that they can't do anything about it. As a matter of fact, you know, that sort of illustrates. Remember the U-2 that was shot down, Gary Powers, that was in 1960. People have said, well, there's got to be a conspiracy. But people forget. Sometimes two different countries will keep a secret, not because they've agreed to do it, but each for his own purpose. The United States wasn't talking about all our U-2 flights over the Soviet Union because they were illegal. We were violating international law. The Russians weren't talking about it. They knew about them because they couldn't do anything about it, and they didn't dare admit that to their people. So here we have two antagonistic groups, both keeping the same secret, but for different reasons. Not a conspiracy, self-interest. And it's the same with those flights I mentioned about the reconnaissance planes being shot down. I forgot to add that, we shot down some of theirs, too. Now, we knew that the planes were shot down. The Russians knew the planes were shot down. They didn't go bragging about it, and we didn't go admitting it. So, you know, it gives the word conspiracy an entirely different meaning when you realize that people have a common interest in secrecy, though they didn't conspire together to do it.
Just different reasons. Self-interest. Yeah,
you know,
But could they, by the same token, I don't think it's too much to take into consideration the fact that the government at the time may have been dealing with a phenomenon that they couldn't explain, and that they went to the press or had connections, political connections to the press, and just said, hey, guys, we don't know what this is, so just lay low on this or you know, give us a little time. Because the one thing that they didn't want to do is most certainly create any more panic with the public.
Well, yeah, and there are several examples of when the press knew something and was instructed not to talk about it. One of them was the Japanese Fugo balloons. These were fancy rice paper balloons carrying incendiary devices that the Japanese released out over the northern Pacific, and the winds carried over the United States, and they hoped that they would set forest fires and kill a lot of people and so forth. The government went to the media and said, you don't say anything about those, because we didn't want them to know how successful or unsuccessful these things were. So it's like a complete vacuum of coverage of Fugo balloons.
Well, look what happened, Stan. Well, look what happened at Roswell with the initial, I can't remember the name of the newspaper, that came out and said Air Force captures flying disc. And then within the space of, what, 48 hours, it was completely
much less than that.
Denied.
But remember,
right.
Now, the original story went out at noon July 8th. Would you believe that was just in time for evening papers from Chicago West? Now, you only see the Roswell Daily Record, but it's on the front page of the Chicago Daily News, of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, of the Sacramento Bee, of the Spokane Chronicle, and a whole bunch of other newspapers. I did a show with, I forget his name, from Saturday Night Live kind of guy.
Stan Aykroyd?
Well, who?
Aykroyd? Dan Aykroyd?
No, not Dan. Dan's very interested and very concerned, and I'll think of the guy's name. But and he makes a big deal on this program that, you know, it couldn't have been a big story. It was only in the Roswell paper. Well, I had sent his producer copies of all these articles I was talking about. And I ranted at him, but, you know, that's why I sent all those papers. It was a big story. It wasn't on the East Coast just because of the timing, you know, because of the time zones. But the press release went out at noon. The cover story went out at 4 o'clock, and the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, front page, Army captures flying saucer, general thinks it's radar weather gadget. Those are full-width headlines. So within 4 hours, the cover story was out there. And the next morning, all the papers, including the East Coast papers, had, you know, Ramey empties Roswell saucer and blah, blah, blah. It was very effective. But my point is that, let me give you another example. The Kennedy once said he wishes the New York Times, which heard about the Bay of Pigs thing coming up, had said something, because then maybe it wouldn't have gone off and it wouldn't have been made to look so foolish. Governments also, the word uranium, there was an early article during World War II, and General Groves let it be known through appropriate channels that you don't talk about uranium, nothing. And they didn't. So what I'm saying is, you're right. The press has connived on occasion.
All right. Let's take this. Let's take it back. And Frank, I wanted to ask a little bit more on these several crashed saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get your opinion. I guess, is the implication here that the United States shot these down? Is that
yes? Most definitely. The 19 hours of sightings over 11 states blamed on a meteor, and it's right in Blue Book that we've seen for 5 to 6 seconds. That was the duration. Yeah, the 19 hours, duration 5 to 6 seconds.
You know, I was talking before about wanting to know the other guy's military capabilities. As Frank has pointed out, we switched from machine guns, which ain't a big deal,
mm-hmm.
to these Mighty Mouse rockets, which are a big deal. They have a much longer range and can do much more damage. And I think the aliens who thought they had it, you know, they had us down pat. They knew what our capabilities were. You've seen loads of stories of airplanes chasing UFOs, and you can just see the guy going back to headquarters. These guys can't go faster than 420 miles an hour. It takes them half a mile to make a turn. We don't worry about them. And then suddenly they've got these blasted little rockets which can cause trouble. And this was all happening. It was in the first deployment of the Mighty Mouse was in 52, wasn't it, Frank?
Right. The F-94Cs were unveiled in July of 52, right before the Washington sightings. And they were used. One thing I discovered is during the Korean War, the jets with all the rockets on board, they never went to Korea because they always feared that the communists would capture them if one went down in enemy territory. So the rocket bearers were over here, and they were around the major cities, mainly Washington, to protect the capital during 52. And that's what was sent out on the two particular back-to-back weekends over Washington in July.
So you've tracked down four.
Pardon?
You've tracked down four.
Yes.
Crashes that you...
In explicit detail.
Okay. That were caused, what you believe, caused by U.S. military shooting them down.
Yes.
Yet they're...
Right during the prime time of the shoot-down orders and disappeared documents trying to find out the two men, Jones and Del Curto, they disappeared off the planet in a radar net for Air Force bases and military radar installations off the coast of Florida. They vanished into thin air. Stanton and I have reviewed the official case, and it is a crying shame how badly it was covered up. Very bad. I go into explicit detail in the book. I was actually caught onto this case several years ago, and like I said earlier, these men were never born, they never died, they were never in the Air Force, and I had never heard so much malarkey from all of the government departments that I spoke with.
They were erased.
But yes, they were erased. The men were erased. And what I actually did is I spoke to the surviving brothers of the pilot and radar operator on that Starfire. The pilot's brother actually kept all the Air Defense Command telegrams and letters from General Chidlaw, who was the head of the Air Defense Command back in 52. And Chidlaw was sending these telegrams to the brother. And it was very interesting, and I remember this struck Stanton when I found this out. The Air Force did not notify the next of kin until 3 days later. The brother was disappeared, dead. That happened Friday, late Friday afternoon, almost early evening, and he wasn't notified until Monday, which is kind of crazy.
Well, they had to get their cover story together, Frank.
They had to get their cover story together. And I was holding these documents for years, and here I am talking to the Air Force and different government agencies, and they're like, we have no records of these men. I even contacted the Social Security Death Index. There was no records for these men dying. They were never born. And here I am holding all the documents and from the brother, of how his brother was... the pilot, John Jones, disappeared, vanished into thin air, never found.
It's a good example of when the government sets out to obscure, obfuscate, whatever words you want to use, lie. There's a piece on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, called Government UFO Lies. And there wasn't room enough to cover all the lies, but I don't discriminate. I have lies from the Air Force, the NSA, the CIA, et cetera. And I say this, you know, I grew up during the war, World War II, and patriotism was not a dirty word back there. And people were quite ready to say, well, okay, when they exploded the first atomic bomb, people saw it from over 100 miles away, and a cover story went out saying an ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately nobody was injured. Well, nobody begrudges lying at that point in time. It had to be done. You know, you could understand not telling people that you'd broken the German and Japanese codes. It was vital that nobody know that we'd done it, because then they'd change them, and we'd be tough out of luck and saving a lot of lives. So people recognize that occasionally you have to do that. But here we have a situation where the government says, basically, these aren't a threat to the security of the United States, and we don't know nothing, and so forth. Then you have to say, well, okay, what's the justification? I don't want all the secrets out on the table. I worked under security for 14 years. I appreciate the need for security on occasion. Suppose we had figured out a better way of tracking objects moving at high speed in the atmosphere. Should we advertise it? Come on, you can't do that. But there comes a time when you say, aren't we entitled to know that the planet's being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft, that the government has recovered some of these, and we've lost airplanes to them, and things like that. When do the citizens' rights come into the picture here?
Really?
I mean, it's bad enough that we can't keep people from abducting Earthlings, aliens from abducting Earthlings. The Hill case that's written about and captured is a good example of that. But, okay, that affects individuals. But as a society, don't we need to know about some of these things going on? I think we do.
Yeah, definitely.
And people say, well, but governments can't keep secrets. How many times I've heard that. Let me give you a couple of examples. The first successful launch of a Corona spy satellite, it was number 13, incidentally, 12 had failed, was in 1960. It got more information about Soviet military installations than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. When was the first public announcement of this great breakthrough? 1995. 35 years later. The NRO, whose very existence was classified for a number of years, National Reconnaissance Office, in 2005 was kind enough to admit that they had launched 7 Poppy satellites to spy on Soviet shipping. When? Oh, back between 1962 and 1971. First public discussion, 2005. And the NRO is known for building expensive and sophisticated spy satellites, some of them running $500 million each.
Wow.
In other words, it's not 4 professors and 12 grad students. Their black budget is estimated, and that's all we can do is estimate, between 10 and 15 billion a year. So there's 2 examples. The fact that we had broken the German Enigma code, you think we talked about that at the end of World War II? Nope. Another 25 years went by.
Hmm.
So there are many examples, and I have others, but that governments can keep secrets, some of them understandable. Certainly the fact that you've broken the other guy's codes is not something you want to broadcast. And many people don't realize how important it was for us to, I'll say it gently, to lie, to put out disinformation. As a matter of fact, when we invaded Europe at Normandy, June 6, 1944, Hitler's generals were saying, bring in the reserves. And Hitler said, no. That's where they want us to think we're attacking this Normandy. They're really going to attack over at Calais under General Patton. So we got to hold back the reserves. And the reason he thought that is that there was a very specific effort to put out disinformation, subtle, sly, pass information on to the German spies, etc. They even put papers hinting at this in the body of a British military officer who had died. They dropped him in the water off Spain, knowing the Germans would get it from Spanish. I mean, that's the depth to which we went. And it was of extraordinary importance that the reserves did not come up right away, or the war might have gone in another direction. So, you know, disinformation is not a dirty word. Standard policy of government. But we'd like to know who the enemy is that we're using this against, you know?
Yeah, makes sense.
To wrap that little segment up there, guys, I want to read something. I found this in the September 12th documents of Project Blue Book. This was a witness in District Heights, Maryland, who made who had the sighting of a UFO that flew at a low altitude. And this is kind of going to wrap up everything we've just been talking about. Now, this is a handwritten note, and here's what the gentleman said. I don't know what it was I saw and will insist on what it was not emphasized. I've seen meteors, and the newspapers will have a hard time telling me I was looking at a meteor on September 12th. Maybe it sounds good to persons who didn't see the object. This thing, emphasized, was being flown. In summarization, this may sound as though I am inferring some fraud in the reports given to the public. Perhaps responsible parties believe they are true and the best information available. But did they see the thing on September 12th?
Hmm.
That was right in Project Blue Book. That's one of the UFOs that flew over treetop level.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Frank, is yes. In retrospect, now that with all your research that you've done and that wonderful illustration that I assume that you did website kind of revamped, do you think that craft that might have crash-landed was swollen by some sort of robot? Was an unmanned probe?
The actual Flatwoods Monster itself?
Was possibly, you know, some sort of robotic device.
The witnesses told me it looked like a space suit. And
okay.
Actually, the inner head area that was described and thought for over 50 years to be the face, actually Kathleen and Freddie, Kathleen May saw this thing the length of a car. She saw it about 12 foot away because it came right out in front of her. And it was actually an inner helmet, and the eyes were actually portholes. And above its head was this gigantic type outer helmet. It was like looked like a cockpit, and it had a plate glass type window in front of it. Freddie May told me that when it lit up, the beams projected out from its eyes. They weren't Buck Rogers laser beams. They were it was light that was forced out from the inside, like at night how the LED lights light up on the dashboard of a car. And that's basically how Freddie described it. This thing lit up from the inside. Kathleen told me, all the witnesses, this thing lit up from the inside, and it looked like it was being maneuvered and controlled by something inside. Freddie described it as mechanical, similar to a suit. What I did is I looked into the Blue Book incidents for the following night, and then I started researching in other directions, and I found out there was an incident that occurred approximately 17 miles away the following night, 24 hours to the minute, where a gentleman called George Snatowski was with his wife and infant. They were driving through Frayntown along the same route, just a little bit down where Levitt was looking the night before, Colonel Levitt. And his car stalled. There was a sulfur smell. He had seen the oval-shaped UFO out in the woods, and he described this thing that was traveling along the side of the road that had come out of the woods, and it was like a reptilian-type creature. But the only difference was, this time it was seen from the waist up with this suit off of it. The lower half was described as the solid torso area, and this thing had the pipes, the same sulfur smell that got the kids sick and Kathleen the night before when they were vomiting. And this is what Snatowski had described the following night. And what I actually did is I went into, I microanalyzed. These little sightings weren't going to be in Project Blue Book, because the people in those areas didn't report to Project Blue Book. I found them in the little weekly papers. And I pinpointed throughout Braxton County on topographical maps that after the Flatwoods Monster craft left, I tracked it following the river and the railroads into the next town. It landed, and it was puddle jumping. It landed in Frayntown a short while later. This is the area where this thing was seen the same night. The Flatwoods craft is the only one that did not show an extended flight path. I tracked all the UFOs moving back out over the United States that night. How the same way I tracked them coming in, I followed them back out. Once again, Blue Book had the majority of the information. Once I caught onto the paper trail through Blue Book and pinpointed my flight path trajectories, then I went into the regional papers and then the smaller papers, and I actually figured the flight paths out. So in other words, this thing that was seen by Snatowski the following night, short distance away, it was this reptilian-type thing in a suit. There's pictures on my website of it. I spoke to George Snatowski a few years ago before he passed away. And I have also found original interviews with Smetowski from back in the 50s where he goes into explicit detail and he tells what actually happened that night. That story was just as scary as what happened in Flatwoods. This guy was pretty paralyzed when this thing happened. So you have, you know, paper trails. You have connections of what was seen. And it was basically some type of a suit. It wasn't like a robot. This was more like a suit. And Freddie May and Kathleen, and I met different witnesses, as Stanton did when Stanton, when he was up in Flatwoods, he met Kathleen May, Freddie May, Edison May, Ronnie Shaver, and we spoke with the witnesses at length in 2002 for the anniversary, and Stanton actually went up to the site.
Well, you know, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to do your research by proclamation, friend. It's not fair.
And how I understood what had happened is Freddie May actually took me step by step from the school playground. We went up the road. We actually drove. I didn't walk the mile and a half, but we drove in the car up to the house, and when we got to the old May residence, he took me step by step and explained everything that happened, and I actually videotaped them.
That's great.
So I knew what went on every second, and I had access onto the farm. Nobody's allowed onto it now. It's privately owned, but I was got to be friends with the family who owned it. So I had access to that farm for several years, and I videotaped it a million times. And what's interesting, if you look on my website, there's photographs of the tree. The tree had deteriorated very badly where the
yes.
so-called monster was. You could see it. It's actually gutted itself. It's uprooted, and there's not much left of it. It looks like a big snow cannoli shell. That's how I can describe it.
There's a picture of it on our website, too, with you in it.
Right. Okay,
I should mention here that I've made disparaging remarks about Dr. Joe Nickel, but this wasn't the only case that he screwed up, if you will. He has had two wonderful explanations for Roswell. At the 50th anniversary celebration, I was in Roswell. He was in Los Angeles. We were being interviewed by some network group. We couldn't see each other, but we could hear each other. And he says, oh, I know what happened there. Oh? Yeah, that PR man, he just made up the story to get attention. I said, you don't even know his name, do you? Well, no. This is Walter Howdy's talking about. I said, well, I've known him for 20 years, and the notion that he would make up a story like this as the public information officer for the most elite military group in the world, the 509th, that Roswell had dropped the nuclear weapons on Japan, both of them, and had dropped two more, 1946 at Operation Crossroads in the Pacific, the notion that he would make up such a story on his own is about as absurd as anything can get. So that was explanation number one, stupid explanation number one. Many months ago on Coast to Coast Radio, somebody sent me a tape of this. He was asked about Roswell. Oh, well, you know, it's very straightforward. When you look at the original data, you find that the rancher brought in just a bunch of sticks and paper and stuff, and then these other people came along and made a big story out of it. There was nothing there. You got to go back to the original data. Well, he's talking about July 9th newspapers. The original data is July 8th, in which it said found last week, not the later discovery. Oh, it was found mid-June, and where the description he's talking about came from this cover story the next day, which violates everything all the other witnesses have talked about. And so I'm waiting for explanation number three. I mean, after all, the Air Force has put forward four explanations for Roswell. First, it was a flying saucer. They didn't use the word UFO back then, you understand. Then it was a radar reflector weather balloon combination. And then fast forward umpteen years, it was a mogul balloon, which doesn't fit in any way. And then my favorite explanation, the crash test dummies, which were only not dropped, none of them were dropped until after 1953, you understand. So we have time travel for crash test dummies, which is kind of neat. I wish I could use it when I travel, you know. But secondly, I talked, and it's funny the Air Force didn't. I found the guy who was in charge of the program. His picture from back in the 50s is in the Air Force report. And I located him in New Mexico and met with him in person, mind you. And he stressed to me, Stan, for those tests to be meaningful, ejection seats and getting out of balloons at high altitude, things like that, the crash test dummies had to be the same size and weight as pilots. They were 6 feet tall, and they weighed 175 pounds. And I have a picture in my book of Flying Saucers and Science, because I couldn't resist. It's so funny, you know, this crazy notion. But what I'm getting at is Flatwoods is not the only case in which the powers that be screwed up royally. It's one of many. It was a pattern of behavior by the debunkers and by the government, with the collusion, if you will, of the media. And so that's why, I mean, I had somebody ask me, Stan, you're a physicist. Okay, why is there a chapter in your book about public opinion polls and about press coverage? That's hardly science. Well, that's true, but these things determine what people do and what they believe. If you think most people don't believe in UFOs, you're not going to report your sighting. If you're a professor, you're not going to sponsor a PhD thesis. You're not going to teach a course. If you're a reporter, you're not going to pursue the truth because you know the editor wants some silly stuff. And the polls show, you see, I get people telling me that you must get a hard time from the press and stuff. And I don't. I've had 11 hecklers and over 700 lectures. And you get that many people talk about sports, religion, politics, or whatever. But the reason I don't get a hard time is because most people believe in flying saucers. The trouble is they think most other people don't. And so they act accordingly. The purpose of the book is to replace mythology with reality. Once people find out that they're not the only ones who see saucers, that the governments have been lying, that a number of prominent and well-known so-called scientists and journalists have not done their best work when it comes to UFOs, then maybe they'll be more ready to speak out. That's why I'm hoping that people will go to my website at www.stantonfriedman.com and let me know about their buddy who was flying F-86s and who went up and never came back. I'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, please do. Hey, Frank, I've got a quick follow-up question. We're coming down on the last couple of minutes of the program. Just to be clear, just so I can clarify not only my own mind but for our listeners as well, the Flatwoods crash, well, it was a crash. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay, and then it was also seen that the Flatwoods, quote, monster, unquote, the entity, was seen in the suit or in the ectoskeleton thingamajing, which is a technical term, and I have a degree for that. All right. It was seen in Flatwoods, but then later the same craft was, as you said, was puddle jumping, and it ended up elsewhere.
It was limping along, I think you could say.
It was limping along, and it was also another one that was in the area.
Okay, same, but this other one had the entity had the suit off.
Yes, the following night.
Okay, the following night.
That was called the Framtown incident.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, we're coming right up here on the end of our show, and very, very interesting stuff. I, for one, had not ever read much about that, but I plan on reading much more, Frank. And I appreciate you coming on and talking about this, and Stanton, you as well. You both added a lot of stuff to the whole big picture.
And this year, Stanton Friedman and myself and several other guests were going to be in St. Albans, West Virginia on September 12th and 13th. It's going to be the Flatwoods Monster 56th year anniversary and Flying Saucer Extravaganza in the city of St. Albans.
Big wing.
And again, where? Where is that?
to St. Albans, just outside of Charleston, in
okay.
West Virginia. Stanton and I and several other guests, Jeff Walmsley's Mothman Investigator, another anomaly from West Virginia. And we're working on finishing up the card, but it's going to be a big show this year.
That's
some of the information is on my website, Larry Bailey, the promoter is handling the entire extravaganza. And if you go on flatwoodsmonster.com, you can keep updated on the persons who are going to be added in the near future.
That's great.
Stanton and I are going to be there.
Yeah.
Certainly appreciate the hard work and the contribution both of you gentlemen have done for the college.
Thank you.
To read your work.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Check out the website. It shows I'm going to be in Roswell, and I'll be in Kansas City on June 7th, and in addition. And so lots of stuff going on. It's great fun.
It is, and it's very interesting. And you know, as Paranexus gets up and going, we've got our conference coming up here in October, and I want to do another plug. Folks, we've got a great conference lineup, and we're hoping and planning and making the effort to get as many attendees as there as possible, because you won't be unhappy with it. You'll be amazed with it. It's a very top-notch professional conference with a host of topics, and as we get more attendees registered, we're going to be able to add more topics, and especially ones such as what we're discussing tonight. So take a look at paranexus.org. We've got charter memberships available right now, $5 for 6 months. Get in there and network with other folks and meet new folks. Broaden your outlook. And if you're just into paranormal research, we'll take a look at UFOs, ufology. Take a look at cryptozoology. Take a look at parapsychology, some different things like that. So we invite everybody to paranexus.org. We really appreciate Frank and Stanton, both of you coming on, taking your time, and spending it with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
And if you'll both hang on with us for just a bit, Grant, always a pleasure with you, my friend.
Oh, same here, Doug, and it was wonderful having both these two gentlemen on with us tonight. I've been a long-time admirer of Stanton, and Frank's work is really wonderful, and we really appreciate both of you folks being on the show with us tonight.
And next week, if you'll join us, same time, 8 o'clock Eastern, Friday night, we've got John Hutchison on our program, the Hutchison Effect, also an interesting program. So everyone, have a great night. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Blog Talk Radio.